Continuing the teaching of the Buddha to Bhukkhasati, as I look at this story and teachings, and it's often the case for many of the teachings, stories connected to the Buddha, I get a sense of a person who's liberated, who's free, who's awake in some deep way, but not someone who's withdrawn from the world, but someone who is engaged in the world. Here he is engaged in teaching Bhukkhasati with a long set of teachings. But in Buddha's engagement to the world, I get a sense, or I feel like he represents doing so with clarity, with purpose, and with confidence. And to hold these ideas kind of together, because we're talking about the Dharma, we're talking about people, we're talking about the maturation of individuals to become awake, become free, and also that to become, to have clarity and a sense of purpose and confidence. And I love this beginning of this text, the fact that these two people are sitting in a potter shed through the evening and to early night with confidence, or in a way that inspires confidence, the Buddha says. The other thing that was meaningful for me was when Andrea yesterday, talked about star stuff. And we're made of star stuff. Because when I was a child, and I would be going to sleep at night, I would lay there awake sometimes with the lights were off in the bedroom. I don't know how much light there was, but maybe because the lights were mostly off, dark. I don't know if my eyes were open or closed, but I would lay there staring into the cosmos. And it just, you know, vast, vast space and galaxies and stars and planets or whatever, just kind of. And the feeling I had laying there in bed, looking into the cosmos, at least my imagination of it, was that I was home, that this was my home, that I was home. So I had part of growing up for me was feeling this is not just the world, I'm at home at the world, but at home in the cosmos. And that as a child, the other thing that came with that was I would contemplate death, wonder what death was like. And in my childish way, maybe, don't have to make too much of it, but I kind of felt that death was final. I didn't have any idea of rebirth or anything else. Come to the end of your life and it's final, it's done. But I had this feeling that this was glorious. Because it was kind of final, but it was kind of like returning to that home, was the feeling I had. Oh yeah, this home, when I die I get to go return to that great, vast, peaceful, magnificent cosmos place. And when I was practicing in Burma, the months that I sat there, I mostly practiced all alone in my room. And sometimes it felt that way, or it was that way, in my mind at least, you know, I was sitting there just alone, not alone, alone maybe, I wasn't lonely, I felt very happy. But just kind of, again, looking into this cosmos, black, great space that was glorious. Stars and galaxies and brain neurons. It's amazing what we have here. So when she talked about star stuff, it reminded me of all that. And so this idea of being home, being free. And a little bit, from what I can gather from these ancient texts, that for someone who is awake, who's liberated like a Buddha, that dying is a little bit like that. Dying is kind of like a, seemingly the texts glorify it. There's kind of a final passing away into this world. It's called the final Nibbana, final Nirvana. And then there's the preliminary Nirvana, Nibbana, that people experience, we tap into in our lives. And so the second of these four foundations that the Buddha taught to Pukkasati is truth. And the idea is to preserve truth, to protect the truth, stay close to the truth. But when the Buddha begins discussing this part of the teaching on truth, he changes the direction of the conversation. Instead of talking about possessing truth, he talks about being supported by truth, having basing one's life on truth. And it's a kind of interesting idea. What would it be like if you based your life on truth rather than anxiety? That would be nice, wouldn't it? What if you based your life on truth rather than the shifting sands of your emotions and feelings and opinions, ideas of who you are? Are the ideas you have of who you are accurate? Do you have a history of extremely accurate self-portrayals? I know for me that I'm kind of still a little bit, I'm often surprised that my self-image is usually about 20 years behind. And so where kind of I've come to my life or where I am or something, or how people see me or something. And you know, I still, you know, I guess it's a common delusion to think you're younger than you are or something. I shouldn't speak for you all, but so to base one's life on, is what can we base on that's true and not, you know, shifting and changing and all the time? So the Buddha, in this passage, he says, one's liberation being based on truth is unshakable. This idea that one's liberation is based on truth, founded on truth, is unshakable. So if you're rooted in the truth, then something about the liberated heart, the heart can be unshakable. The mind doesn't have to be agitated. And then the Buddha goes on and says, for that is false, which has a deceptive nature. So we're talking about truth, right? So now he says, well, what's false, not true, is that which has a deceptive nature. So, you know, my self-image can have, and my opinions and my grand conclusions about what is, you know, a fair percentage of the time, they have a deceptive nature. They're not always deceptive, not always wrong, but they have a quality, an aspect where they can deceive us. We can get hooked into them, we can take them to be more important than they are, we can believe them too closely, we can fixate on them, we can push them away, reject them. Something has a deceptive nature is one that we get, kind of like we get tricked by. And one of the classic ones in that Buddhism emphasizes is we often get fooled into thinking things are more permanent than they are, more stable than they are. And one of the very kind of powerful things that happen in practice, like on retreat, is when the kind of discursive mind that's thinking all the time begins to quiet down, and really kind of be with the elements, with the direct experience of what's going on, that it's possible to see how things shift and change and much more. I can be sitting here thinking about something that seems very important to think about. You know, the mind has a mind of its own, what it should think about, and sometimes I can sit here and it's almost, sometimes I think I'm with my breathing, but I'm really kind of thinking about some wonderful plan or something, concern I have. And then, and I kind of know I'm doing that, but some points I kind of wake up a little bit more and I kind of say, oh, I'm really thinking. I'm really like lost in, you know, having this whole conversation in my head. And at some point I'm able to kind of bring a lot of mindfulness to it and it doesn't really grab me as much and it quiets down a little bit. And what I was thinking about was, you know, for example, that, I mean, all kinds of things, right? But I could be thinking that I have shoulder pain, which I do a little bit, and think, oh, this is, you know, this shoulder pain is going to be here forever, and this is it for me now, and no more racquetball, which I don't even play to begin with. You know, never play racquetball, and this is going to limit my life, and you know, it might be true. Some of these thoughts are true enough, but kind of this idea of never, always, or you know, give us kind of permanence to some of these ideas. But when the mind gets mindful enough or quiet enough, the amazing thing happens. I see that the thought of having that about shoulder pain and what it means, that's impermanent. I can see it rise, there it comes. And then it goes. And if I'm lost in it, it doesn't, it kind of just, it's just there, just like taken for granted, it's like just there. And then I'm there in it, and the beliefs, the content of the thoughts kind of lend itself to fool me, deceive me into the idea that things are permanent. Maybe things are permanent, but what's fascinating, some things, is to watch the arising of a thought. If you're at that stage of practice where you're not in the thoughts and going down the road of thoughts, but see a thought arises and a thought passes. And that it gives the opportunity to have a different relationship with thoughts and the content of thoughts. Because then it's not so, you see, well, you know, maybe there's more going on here. There's a process going on. The content comes and goes. And maybe I don't have to be involved in it. I don't have to participate in those thoughts. The thoughts are what they are. And sometimes I have this idea that when I'm able to watch a thought arise and pass, it's kind of like painting with watercolors on a moving river. I've never tried it, but I imagine it's not possible. Right, that it just won't, you know, the paint won't stay where it's supposed to stay, so I can make my picture. It's already kind of flowing away. As soon as I have put the water paint on the, brush it on the top of the river, it's already rushing away. So they can watch a thought arise and pass. Thought might be true enough, but see it arise and pass. And then to say, you know, maybe I don't have to be involved in it. Maybe there's a choice here to leave it alone and allow it to leave me alone. Thank you. Just kind of there, it comes and goes. So it's a way of stepping away from the way that thinking and concepts have a deceptive nature or deceptive aspect to them. They can fool us and trick us into seeing the world a particular way, seeing ourselves a particular way. That's harder to do when the mind is present enough to watch things, the thoughts arise and to pass. There's a thought coming. And not, you know, just, it's more interesting to notice. And then when the mind gets quieter still, to actually feel, to feel, viscerally kind of feel, that we're better off not getting involved in the thought. It's just actually nicer to have, you know, to have it quiet. It's nicer not to, the thoughts are kind of, it's kind of agitated to get involved or get hooked on or spin around, and kind of tiring. And so to say, oh, what's better, to get involved in thinking or, you know, to stay peaceful, stay at ease, and just stay here quiet? And you have to answer that question for yourself, but, at some point I think when the mind gets quiet and clear and alert enough, you can actually feel that it's so much nicer not to get involved in all this discursive thought, having the conversations that you've had 100 times before, making plans you've done many times over and over again, or all kinds of things. Just so to see things thought arise and pass and choose not to, choose that you're better off without it. And later, I mean, it'll come back. You don't have to worry. You're not going to betray your thoughts. They'll get plenty of opportunities. So the fact that you're choosing for a few minutes in meditation not to get involved in thoughts is, who knows, your thoughts might be relieved too. This person's always bothering me. So what is false or untrue is that which has a deceptive nature. And that which is true is that which has an undeceptive nature. What's true, that is something that doesn't deceive us. And one of the idea of truth in Buddhism, it has many connotations what this word truth means. But one of the ideas is that it's that which it will never be deceptive, never trick you into anything else. It's just clear what it is somehow. Or it's universal. It's something we all share, we all can see. And one of the things that is considered to be truth that we all share, that's maybe is undeceptive and it was true, is that of impermanence, of change. And we all share that. It's like if you sit at the front door of IRC for a few years, just sit there and watch. The first day you're there, there might be all kinds of drama goes on in IRC. You know, so you get all excited about the drama. But then the second day, and third day, and the fourth day, and after a while you get a sense, oh, people come and go. People are great, wonderful, but people come, they go, they come, they go. And there's something about the coming and going which is true. Something about the coming and going which maybe creates a little different context of understanding things than if we're only kind of taking each thing that arises so important in and of itself. This is the thing, this is the person, this is whatever. Comes and goes. Something about the coming and going, which Buddhism says is true. The changing nature of it. And so what is it that has an undeceptive nature? In this text, the Buddha says it's nibbana. It's nirvana. So I wanted to read a few quotes for you about that the Buddha says about nibbana. It is for the sake of nibbana, without clinging, liberation without clinging, that the holy life is lived under the Blessed One. Just as the river Ganges inclines towards the sea, slopes toward the sea, flows toward the sea, and reaches the sea, so too the Buddha's assembly, with its homeless ones and householders, inclines to nibbana, slopes toward nibbana, flows toward nibbana, and reaches nibbana. The holy life is grounded upon nibbana, culminates in nibbana, and ends in nibbana. This supreme state of sublime peace has been discovered by the Buddha, that is, liberation through not clinging. The supreme state of sublime peace, liberation through not clinging. So this is of liberation through not clinging, nibbana through not clinging. The idea of somehow not clinging to anything. So we're stardust 2.0. Or 3.0. Because we're stardust that has some amazing abilities. One of them is that if we're made up of star stuff, then we're star stuff that can know itself. We have star stuff that has ability to perceive and be conscious. It's kind of like the universe being able to know itself. And there's a lot of star stuff that doesn't have that ability. But somehow it's evolved, so there's consciousness and awareness. And then because we can be conscious and aware, and we mobile and have to figure out how to get along in this world, it seems like we have all kinds of mental capacities that are pretty awesome, including the capacity to cling. And it turns out that clinging is optional. That if we want to be liberated and free, set the heart free in this home of ours, in this universe of ours, that it helps if you don't cling. But we're left with consciousness. We're left with awareness. We're left with a heart. We're left here in this vast, wonderful world. And so just this thing of clinging is the kind of the key to all of the Dharma, to not cling. And so there's another passage. A person who has heard that nothing is worth clinging to has heard When a person has heard that nothing is worth clinging to, that person directly knows everything. Isn't that kind of nice? And this is a kind of little kind of semantic, wonderful semantic trick in the Buddha that great religious teachers back in those times were supposed to know everything, be omniscient. So he was happy to go along with that. Sure, I'm omniscient. I know that everything's impermanent. He knows something about everything. He doesn't know everything about everything, but he knows something about everything. He knows that everything changes. But also, if a person has heard that nothing is worth clinging to, one knows everything. Or everything that, you know something about everything. Some aspect of everything. You know that nothing warrants clinging to. Nothing in this universe. Having directly known everything, one fully understands everything. Having fully understood everything, whatever feeling one feels, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, the person abides observing the impermanence of those feelings, observing their fading away, observes their cessation when they're not there, and then observes the relinquishment, the drive, the compulsion to cling to them, to hold on to them. Observing like this, a person does not cling to anything in the world. When one does not cling, one is not agitated. When one is not agitated, one personally attains nibbana. So nibbana, it's, we're not, what exactly is it? It comes with not clinging, comes with some aspect of the mind, some place in the mind that's not agitated, some recognition of being pristinely still here. It's easy to take Nibbana as a thing, but many of the, in this book here, you know, many of the times when the Buddha, when the translation to English uses the word Nibbana, it's actually translating a verb rather than a noun. And the verb means to cool, or to release, or to unbind, or to blow out, or it can also mean to calm, or to bring to peace. Nibbana is maybe more like an activity than a place or a thing. It's the activity of releasing, of letting go. And that, in that letting go, in the not clinging, that wonderful feeling of the fist releasing, the fists of the heart releasing. And it's a little bit, or quite a bit, an experience of absence. Rather than the presence of something, it's a lot to do with what's not there. And often we don't really give a lot of attention to what's absent. And especially when mindfulness, we're supposed to pay attention to everything that's there. Often that's what it says, you know, notice what's happening in the experience. But also the human mind is often oriented very much to content, to things, to objects. So even if you, in a room like this we're in here, it's fairly natural to be more interested in the things in the room than the space in the room. Sometimes it's more interesting to know for the mind to notice the sounds in the room than the silence in the room. There's space in this room. There's actually more space in the room than there are stuff, people. And space makes a difference. And it can make a difference subconsciously. We don't think about it. But if this room was about a third of the size, and we all kind of crammed in here, in order to sit and walk and practice, you would really feel the lack of space. And then if suddenly the room got bigger, you'd appreciate, oh, this feels better. And if this was twice as big, or if we had a really high ceiling, big cathedral, there's big spaces sometimes that are very inspiring, partly because of the nature of this vastness of the space. One of the elements in this text here, the six elements, is the element of space, something people usually don't pay attention to. I find that there's something about presence, about awareness, consciousness, that from time to time can feel like it partakes or similar to qualities of space. They say that just as like space, like we have here, we can throw dirty things into the space and the space doesn't mind. Nothing happens, you know, space just receives it all. No problem for space. So the same thing with awareness. It's possible to have an awareness that's like space, where things happen, and it doesn't have to stick anywhere, it doesn't have to go anywhere. Just like they say that bird leaves no trail flying through the sky. So it's possible to have thoughts go through the mind and leave no trail, no trace. Because the mind, the awareness, can be like space. But it's hard to feel that or see that when we're very concerned, perhaps compulsively, with the ideas and concepts and thinking and our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions. We're very concerned with our sensations in our body, there can be a strong drive. Sometimes even with mindfulness, people are very mindful, but there's a kind of a drivenness in the drive, in the mindfulness, like, it's so important, I gotta get to this, I have to stare my experience down, I have to penetrate it, I have to, you know, the doing gets activated, and I have to kind of really connect well. And being connected well in mindfulness is good, for sure. But it's interesting to start noticing the strength of the mind to be involved in ideas and concepts, and being involved in being aware of things, wanting things, looking, concerned. So if a person knows that nothing is worth clinging to, even if they, then in this passage, then there's the next thing to notice is how things are rising and passing, feelings arise and pass. The direct experiences we have with our body and our senses arise and pass. Our concepts don't arise and pass so much. But the direct building blocks for our experience, the direct immediacy of it, changes all the time. And so begin tuning into that, or appreciating that, or valuing that. The immediacy of this practice, quite something to come into the immediacy of our life, the immediacy of this moment. I took a philosophy class many years ago in college, and maybe the only concept I remember from the class is the concept of the saddleback of the present moment. I have no idea what they meant exactly, but I guess for me, I guess the idea of saddleback is kind of like a U shape. And how often are we resting at the bottom of the U? The present moment, the now, the immediacy of here. Often, you know, it's like we put a marble ball down, you know, U-shaped slope, and it'll go down up the other side, and come down up the other side a little bit, and the momentum goes out, it finally comes to rest at the bottom of the U. Unless some well-meaning person is that's, you know, standing there as the ball goes by and gives it a shove. It can go on for a long time. Sisyphus, and, you know, pushing the rock up the hill forever. And we're often doing that with our thoughts. You know, we're kind of like getting involved and stirring them up and pushing them along. But to the immediacy of this moment here, it's actually a place of rest. Something becomes still here. We're really here, right here. The mystery of the present, the majesty of the present, the simplicity of the present, here, the experience. And in that immediacy, that's where we start seeing things arise and pass. Arise and pass, coming and going. And the reason why Buddhist practice emphasizes this insight into impermanence arising and passing is because it becomes clear that the things that arise and pass is not really worth clinging to, holding on to, because they're already gone before you before you cling to them. If you're resting in the present, things pass through, and even before, by the time you reach for them, they're already gone. The immediacy of our experience. And being aware of this, one does not cling to anything in the world. When one does not cling, one is not agitated. And not agitated, one personally experiences Nibbana, or here the word is not experienced as Nibbana as a thing, one is personally Nibbanized. More literally, that's how it should be translated. One is Nibbanized. Isn't that nice? And I like to think of this as released, unbound, released. One is personally released. And one of the reasons I like this, being released, Nibbanized, is not a few people are looking for Nibbana. They're like the state, where is it? The thing, Maybe it's not a thing exactly. It's true. Nibbana is true. And that's what the Buddha says in this passage. That's undeceptive. Release is undeceptive. Release is true. Freedom is true. Unclinging is true. So to preserve the truth, I don't know if the truth needs to be preserved, but to value it and stay close to it. And one of the truest things, this tradition here, things that you can base your life on and support you in your life, is to is this Nibbanized, the release, the opening of the clenched fist. Though sometimes the opening of the clenched fist takes time, as we go gently, compassionately, one finger at a time. And then we try the other finger to open it up. Then the first one goes back. And then, come on, you're gonna. It's okay. It's safe. It's okay to do this. It's a good thing to do. You'll be okay. Then you do two fingers, test the waters. Then you go to slowly release the third finger. And the two is flat back. It takes a while to develop the trust. Deep trust that it's okay. It's really okay. It's okay to relax. It's okay to not cling. It's okay not to resist. It's okay to just be open and present. In the simplicity of this moment, it's okay to just be in the bottom of the saddleback of present moment, in the simplicity of this moment, this immediacy. It's okay to let your heart be at peace, be still. And not only is it okay, but it's a way of better caring for ourselves. It's a way of better respecting ourselves. It's a way of better caring for the world. To have a heart which is at ease, at peace. So have you, in your years of being alive, ever had an experience of releasing some grip you had in your heart or your mind? You ever had the experience of letting go of something in a wonderful way, where, that's good. Release. Some people have a really good pooping. But could it be in the heart too? Something that good? Just let go. Relax. Good riddance. Free at last. Have you ever had an experience of release that, that was visceral, that you can remember? And what I'd like to suggest is that experience of release, of letting go, that maybe that gets That's an important reference point for you. It's easy to forget it, just like it's easy to lose track of the space that's here. Because there's so many important things to hold on to, so many important next things. You have to go to the next thing, right? Next, you know, if you... But if you can remember that experience, and kind of remember, oh, get a sense, it can be a little bit of a guide, it can be a little bit of a support, a little bit show you the direction, show you a possibility, show you what's possible, so that we can base our life on truth, base our life on the truth of release. And there's something undeceptive, there's something true about that freedom, that release. To trust it, to appreciate it, to let it be the North Star, a guide, a support, to help you show you the way through this world, through the practice here, now. Thoughts come and go. And what happens if you're more aware of the coming and go nature of thoughts than you are in what you're thinking about? And what is true when you have no thoughts to tell you? When you don't use thoughts to answer the question about what is true? What is true? In the space between thoughts, the space beyond thoughts, around thoughts, vast space and vast peace, so close at hand, here and now.